You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
At which point we were separated and I was thrown into a Soviet military cell. It was at that point that the funny side of what had happened diluted somewhat.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss a single episode. This is the second part of my interview with Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Harrison, MBE, who served for 2 years as a full-time touring officer with Bricksmiths. In this episode, we hear of Stephen's imprisonment in a Soviet army jail, following a detention in a Soviet garrison town, as well as East German and Soviet army press coverage about his activities. Stephen's speciality was using his language skills to engage and befriend opposition troops and thereby gain valuable intelligence. He used to go into bars frequented by Soviet officers and recalls one particularly drunken night in Potsdam. Stephen also shares details of the top secret Operation Tomahawk, a particularly unpleasant mission which may not be for those of a sensitive disposition. In later years, Stephen obtained his Stasi file, which reveals that the surveillance on him was far closer than he'd ever believed. Cold War history is disappearing, but a simple monthly donation will keep this project going and allow me to continue preserving these incredible stories. You'll join our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm very proud to support Cold War Conversations with a small donation each month because Ian's put together such a brilliant range of interviews. If you do support the podcast, your wallet will be a tiny bit lighter, but your brain will be very, very thankful.
Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Stephen Harrison to our Cold War conversation.
I was only detained once by the NVA, and that was by the signals people. We had stumbled across a signals deployment exercise taking place. We decided to have a closer look. And the NVA set up an ambush for us, and they managed to detain us. And in order to escape, we would have had to reverse through people who were blocking the vehicle. And when I tried to engage them in conversation in my normal style, they didn't want to know. There was not a single word that was uttered by them. There was just weapons raised, and of course, the British liaison mission didn't recognise East German authority. Our right to be in East Germany was accorded to us by the Soviets, and therefore, whenever East Germans tried to detain us, whether that was Volkspolizei or NVA, we would protest that this was illegal, that we had the right of freedom of movement under the Robertson-Malinin Agreement, and that how dare they restrict this. And they were to summon immediately the local Soviet commandant, and we were not going to negotiate with them. To give you an idea of the lengths that they were prepared to go to, I mentioned earlier when we overturned in our vehicle and hit the deer and all the rest of it. Eventually, an NVA unit turned up and they detained us. And I protested and said that they had no right to detain us. I mean, in fact, we weren't going anywhere because my vehicle was upside down. But anyway, they had no right to detain us, and we insisted on the attendance of the local Soviet commandant. Well, what this chap did, and I had spoken to the NVA officer in Russian because I wanted to impress upon him that our right to be there was accorded by the Russians. We did not recognize the NVA, so I only spoke Russian. He handed me a document Because they also spoke Russian. Most of the NVA officers spoke Russian. He handed me a document and he asked me to sign it. And I asked him in Russian what it was. And he said, it's nothing. It's just what this does is gives me the authority to bring out a crane. It's called an 8T210. Bring out a crane and put your vehicle back on its wheels again. We can't deploy these assets without a signature. Well, I read the document. It was written in German, and it was a full confession to having been caught spying in East Germany. So I declined to sign that. But that was the sort of lengths that they would go to. They were much sharper than the Soviets. You had to be on your guard when dealing with the NVA. But of course, we didn't recognize any East German authorities, which is the same reason why if they were told to stop by the Volkspolizei, if they deployed their vehicles and stood in the middle of the road and put their blue lights on and all the rest of it, we just drove around them and waved happily and ignored them because we were there by virtue of the Soviet-British agreement. Mm. Nothing to do with the East Germans at all, which really, really bugged them. It really irked them that we were operating like this in their country and not obeying their orders, which, of course, for the East German population were everything. You know, there was a police state, and for someone to wave at a police officer as they were trying to detain you and just swerve around them, It just would never happen. Would never happen in East Germany.
I can imagine. So when you are detained, what is the procedure there? You wait for the Soviets or the local commandant to turn up, and then what is the routine there that they go through?
It depends on the nature of the detention. Some detentions were quite benign. And in some cases, I would accept a detention when I could have escaped because the Soviets were trying to detain us in an area which they thought was restricted. I knew was not restricted. And therefore, by taking a hit, taking a detention, you could then initiate a protest, or a protest would be made at much, much higher levels. Other detentions were much more violent. And there's a history of violent detentions, of people being dragged from their cars and cars being ransacked, rammed, fired at. I mean serious road accidents, which resulted in detentions. So there was no real template. But once things had calmed down, the Soviet commandant was summoned. Remember, I mentioned to you earlier the Kommandatura vehicle. So, mm-hmm. Someone from the commandant's office would appear, and he would appear, and he would engage you in conversation and ask you what you were doing here, and it invariably ask you to sign what he called an act, which was written in Russian, which again invited you to admit to having carried out spying activities, all the rest of it. He, and only he, could demand your Soviet ID card from you. If anybody else demanded to see your Soviet ID card, you were not obliged to show it to them. But if the commandant did, you had to give them, and he could take them away. In fact, I've got my ID card here, which I kept. About a week before I left Berlin for the final time, I conveniently lost my Soviet ID card, and the reason I kept it was only because of, I don't know whether you can see it there, the top top corner, the irony, yeah, of the irony of the military number that they gave me.
So Stephen's showing me the ID card here, and his ID number starts 007.
and we thought that was a real hoot. The Soviets never really did get it. I don't think they had watched any of that nonsense. So the commandant would arrive, and you would then engage in conversation with him. He would invite you to sign an act. He would wag his finger at you and escort you out of the area. And that's on the assumption that it had been whilst you were engaged in some intelligence gathering activity. Where we had not been engaged in that, but we decided to take the hit, then the initiative was with the tour. So I was on a tour once with a fiery Scotsman, and it was a long tour. It was six days and five nights. And we carried with us only a certain amount of fresh rations. And on day four or five, I decided we were going to go and buy some bread. So we went into the local garrison town, And this local garrison town on the official Soviet map was not in a restricted area. All the tours had this map with us, which was signed by the chief of staff of the group of Soviet forces in Germany. It denoted exactly where the tours could and could not go. Well, this garrison town, which was right next to Letzlinger Heide training area, was in an open area. The problem was the local Soviet garrison didn't know that. They just assumed that any bricksmiths or mission vehicle in their area was immediately to be detained. So this Scotsman and I went in there, we hopped out the vehicle and we went into the bread shop, and I was busy ordering my sliced white, whatever. And in came the town patrol, consisting of an officer and two soldiers, all armed, and they immediately grabbed us. And you could tell that they were animated, and they frog marched us out of the shop. I was protesting all the time, but I knew that what they were doing was illegal. I had no idea what they were going to do with us. In the meantime, the driver who was parked outside the shop, he just sort of gingerly started the vehicle and followed us at walking pace. And a small crowd gathered, and we were frog marched down down the equivalent of Aldershot High Street, and taken into this barracks, at which point we were separated, and I was thrown into a cell. I was thrown into a Soviet military cell. And it was at that point that the funny side of what had happened diluted somewhat, and I became a little bit concerned, not least for the welfare of the driver and the tour NCO. But, and not to look a gift horse in the mouth, it was possible from where I was to read the notice boards outside the cells, giving all the details of the duty officer roster and the name of the unit commander, the number of the unit and all the officers. So I managed to jot all those down. Anyway, we were left there for some time. We were given nothing to eat or drink. And during this time, as I subsequently found out, there were phone calls being made back to headquarters, GSFG in Zossen. We've captured the Brits. And then someone must have said, well, actually, they're allowed to be there. And so what happened after several hours was that a very apologetic commandant came and opened the door of my cell and invited me out and offered me an apology, and then invited me back into the commanding officer's office, where the commanding officer had to stand up and issue a formal apology for having detained me and manhandled me and the tour NCO in this way. Then after that, he broke out the vodka and the stale bread and blinis and caviar. Over the next couple of hours, we put the world to right over a few shots of vodka, and then we were released with, you know, lots of bonhomie and waves. But until that point, I must admit, the prospect of being incarcerated in a Soviet military jail wasn't amusing. But inevitably, the protests were made, and the Soviets did issue a formal apology, and I showed them the map. I showed them the map we have, because I used to carry the map with me, and I said, no, we are in an open area. I said to the commanding officer, are you telling me that you, a lieutenant colonel, know better than three-star General Kolesnikov, or whatever his name was, who signed this map, and he says we can be here, and you say we can't. Now, should we ring him and see who's right? And he just... He completely dismissed me. He was absolutely cock-a-hoop that they had arrested the British spies. But later on, he did admit that he hadn't been aware of this map that I had shown him, that we had been correct, that the detention had been unlawful, and no hard feelings, mate. That's how that one ended.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Did you have any incidents crossing Glinica Bridge?
One of the sentries who operated the gates on Glinica Bridge. I used to chat to these people as they were processing documents, and I asked him for some Soviet military badges, and he said he didn't have any then, but he would have them next time. And next time we crossed the Glinica Bridge from East Germany back into West Berlin, I did give him some East marks. So not West marks. I did give him some East marks. And he gave me a little cellophane bag full of badges. I did so without the authority to do so. It was a real error of judgment on my part. That was protested by the Soviets. They obviously found out. Maybe they had cameras. I'm sure they did have cameras. And it was part of a protest that was made against me, not just on its own, but as part of a wider protest against my activities in the mission. And I've got actually the formal statement here about what they were saying that I was up to. And it resulted in press coverage about what they thought I was doing in East Germany and my scurrilous behavior, and it concentrated on what I liked to do, which was talking to people. And they were convinced that I was some sort of professional intelligence gathering agent who was hell-bent on turning both civilians and military personnel and bribing them for information and bits and pieces. And so they concocted this story, and I was in the amusing position of being the chief's interpreter when he was summoned to the headquarters of the group of Soviet forces in Germany, in Zossen. And he was given a dressing down. My chief of mission was given a dressing down by the colonel general, three-star general, Soviet general, about me. And I was the interpreter. So
brilliant.
I ended up having to translate all sorts of things about which I was meant to have done, and then listen to the chief's explanations of what had happened and what he would do about it. It was, you know, I can look back at it now and smile, but it wasn't amusing at the time. But the Soviets had got it into their head that I was, first of all, a chemical weapons specialist. Secondly, I was a military train specialist. And thirdly, that I was engaged in trying to turn, bribe, corrupt Soviets during the course of my work. And it is true. I did go on town tours, which were dressed in normal British military uniform. We used to go into a garrison town in an open area with the sole intention of just going to places where the Soviet officers went to socialize, because Soviet soldiers were never allowed out of barracks. Only Soviet officers were allowed out of barracks ever. So we would go to their pubs and just go in there normally a silence came across the bar as the Soviets.
It's like going into one of those Western saloons,
yes,
was it?
A bit like that. But it didn't take long for barriers to break down. And if one of the political officers were there, then you wouldn't get any joy at all. All the Soviet officers would be told to leave us alone, not engage with us. But more often than not, they weren't there. And I remember going there together with an officer, again, who's sadly no longer with us, who was in the intelligence corps, also a Russian speaker. And we were self-driving, and we were driving an Opel Senator 3-litre Brixmas vehicle.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And we went to this garrison town, and we got involved with these Soviets, and we were arguing the toss about Afghanistan. We were comparing pay scales. We were talking about uniform, about everything. And we got absolutely hammered on whatever it was they were drinking. And it got to sort of chucking out time. And I thought my colleague was going to drive, and he thought I was going to drive, and we were completely wrecked. So we had to negotiate the very short trip about 2 miles to the mission house in our Opel Senator, when we were certainly not fit not fit to drive. So that's an admission I've made on this podcast. But so it was inevitable that the Soviets formed the impression that because I was quite gregarious and just loved chatting and meeting people, they thought that I was some steely-eyed, tensile steel spring of a spy whose job it was to turn them. And so they turned on me.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's what your ID card said as well, so you can hardly blame them. I think it's really interesting because your approach of actually going into the pubs that the Soviet officers were drinking in, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, they're called town tours. We also did cultural tours, but that wasn't so much going into pubs where the Soviet officers were. That was taking our families, including children, in a marked VW bus, number 10 it was called, and we would go and spend a couple of days in, well, wherever we wanted to in East Germany. So we used to go to Dresden, Leipzig, Rostock, all sorts of places, and we would just go and be there. We'd stay in a hotel. We would eat in restaurants. We would go shopping, and of course the narcs, the Stasi, used to come out in their droves to follow us, and even engaged my daughters in conversation in a shop and asked them what their daddy did and all this sort of stuff. But it was laughable. We always knew when we had surveillance, and my wife used to love it when we had surveillance because she used to, you know, play and hide around corners and stuff like that, which was unnecessary. But again, they were made themselves so obvious that it was impossible to ignore them. But on those occasions, we would quite openly walk the streets of Dresden or Leipzig or Karl Marx Stadt or all the major cities in East Germany where we had the right to be, just to exercise that right. And we would chat to people, and we would talk to Russians, we'd talk to East Germans, we'd talk to people who were visiting East Germany on business or on holiday, just to fly the flag. Normally got quite a frosty reception in Dresden, mind, particularly when I went down there with a couple of RAF officers. But other than that, generally people were very amenable. It was again amusing that wherever we went in East Germany, whenever we booked into a hotel, we found out when we compared notes afterwards that whenever anybody went to the, for instance, the it's called the Hotel Elephant in Dresden, Brixmas families were always given the same rooms. Always given the same rooms.
I wonder why. And were you in dress uniform for those tours, or yeah, or in your jumpers?
No, we're in dress uniform. In dress uniform. Right. So it would be number 4 dress or number 2 dress or service dress for officers. So we're in full dress uniform. No combats. We weren't trying to be soldiers. We were soldiers on holiday. We were having our holiday, and the East Germans thought this a really strange concept that we would. Why do you want to come here? Why are you here? And we would say, well, it's clearly for the food and the accommodation.
Must have caused quite a stir, I guess, in some towns.
Well, it did. I remember going with a warrant officer, again, another warrant officer in the SAS, one evening when we had little else to do, and we decided to go and pay Colditz Castle a visit. And this was in 1987. And we drove to Colditz, and the first thing we did was we went to the station, which was deserted, and we each had our photos taken underneath the Colditz sign under the station. And then we went up into the castle, and we drove up into the castle, and it was in complete darkness, and we parked in the courtyard, and it was almost like being watching the film series back in the 70s. I remember watching Colditz, and there's this huge cobbled courtyard, and we tried various doors, and none of the doors worked. And eventually we went up this flight of stairs, and we tried this door, and it opened. And in front of us was a huge dormitory, and it was full of men, most of them either naked or just partially dressed, and with some attendants who were all dressed in white. And some of the attendants came rushing over towards us, and there was a huge commotion, and we were bundled back out of the door. And I saw, and this chap said, "What? Who the hell are you? What are you doing here?" And I explained to him, you know, British mission. And he said, "You can't come in here. You cannot come in here. These people are unpredictable." So at that time, it was being used as an asylum for people with mental health issues, and people who like that in East Germany, they were just locked away. And what better place than in Colditz? Anyway, we were escorted to the office of the, I don't know what he was called, the commandant, the boss man, and he explained to us what was going on there, and it took us on a small tour, and we got very friendly chatting. This was late at night. It was a cold night, and I said to him, you know, what is it that you really miss here? And he said, do you know what, none of us here, patients, staff, have had fresh fruit in a long time. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we left. We apologized for having disturbed this. We didn't know it was a mental health asylum. And we went back to West Berlin, and we organized a trip down with Number 10. And we went to the shops in West Berlin, and we bought basket loads of fruits, not just commonly available fruits, you know, bananas and apples and stuff. But we bought loads of things like kiwi fruits and cherries and pineapples and mangoes and all sorts of things. And it was a bucket load of stuff. And we took it down there and we delivered it. And the chap who was in charge of college, he just burst out crying. Anyway, to cut this to an even shorter story, thereafter, he invited any of the Bricksmith cultural tours to come along to Colditz, and he would give them a tour around the unoccupied parts of the castle. And in exchange, we would always deliver baskets of fruit, which were handed out to staff and patients alike. I can't remember how we got onto this subject.
I don't care, to be honest. It's a great story. It's a great story.
Yeah.
Now, you made it into Neues Deutschland, the East German Communist Party paper, and Red Star, the Soviet Army paper as well.
Yeah. Yes, I did. Yes. It was the incident I was talking about earlier, where the Soviets raised questions as to what I was really up to in East Germany, and that I was involved in the recruiting and turning of people. And I, at the time, and to a certain extent now, I regarded it really as a badge of honor, really, that the Soviets thought that was happening to me. It says, I've got the report here. This was the report written by my boss. It said, his linguistic abilities, his skills as a tourer, made him a particular threat to the Soviets. His menace was acknowledged when the Soviets deliberately prefabricated and published a series of allegations against him in the hope of curtailing his activities. So, interestingly enough, the other reports that I've read about me were generated by the secret police, the Stasi. So when the wall came down in 1989, the Stasi tried to destroy as many of the files they had, not just on us, but on East German citizens. And a mechanism, they didn't manage to destroy all of them. In fact, I think only about a third managed to destroy. A mechanism was set up then for people, anybody, to apply to the German government to have their Stasi files. So I applied, and fortunately mine were not destroyed, and I received 186 pages of files which the Stasi had generated on me, on my wife, on my children. They knew my address in West Berlin. They knew my telephone number in West Berlin. They knew my car registration number in West Berlin. There was a lot of stuff in that report which was laughable. They thought I was doing things which I wasn't. They thought I was much more capable than I really was. So a lot of it, I think, was made up in order to justify the Stasi in the first place. But there was one particular incident where their account of what happened was alarmingly accurate. And in fact, in order for them to have reported on what I was doing, they would have had to be extremely close to me, which, again, I was very alarmed about, because, well, at the time, if you had asked me if I was clean from surveillance, I would have guaranteed you that I was, because I had was taking out one of the senior officers in Brixmas, and our job when taking out one of the senior officers was to show him a little bit of excitement, but certainly not put him in any danger. And in this report by the Stasi, they report me what I said to the senior officer, what I was saying to the driver, that the driver and I got out and we had a cigarette, and I smoked silk cut cigarettes, and it was with a green lighter, and what we had to eat, and it was incredibly accurate. How they achieved this, I don't know. Normally, the Stasi that we dealt with were alarmingly amateur. They operated in groups of three, young men, shades, black leather jackets, in a Lada or a Wartburg. You could tell them a mile away. But on this occasion, they clearly had the wherewithal to mount a surveillance operation on me. I was in an observation, not really an observation post, but we were observing rail lines in a place which I had used before. So perhaps that's one giveaway. I had gone back to a place which I thought was safe because I had used it before. And they recorded the whole thing. So I translated my Stasi files into English, and I showed my daughters this, and their eyes just glazed over when they read all this nonsense. But it showed me that the Stasi didn't have a real feel for the sensitive things that we were up to. A lot of it was fabricated, apart from this one incident that I mentioned. So they didn't know of any of the sense. They didn't know about the rubbish dump operations. They didn't know about any of the other bits and pieces that we got up to at night. At least it wasn't reported upon. I've still got the Stasi files here. So that was really the only two occasions when I was reported upon. Neues Deutschland, which was the East German newspaper, and Krasnaya Zvezda, the Red Star Soviet military paper. And my Stasi files, with multiple reports in the files of the Mission House staff in Potsdam interviewing my daughters, who were, gosh, what were they, 6 and 4 at the time, trying to get information from my daughters, and having microphones in the bedrooms and all sorts of things. So it was.
And how did your daughters react to that when they read that in a file?
They had no, they had absolutely no idea. And in fact, much later on, in another existence, I was working in Russia in the early 90s, and our flat was bugged. The lady who came to clean for us, she wasn't what she said she was. Even our driver, he was working for somebody else. The girl's riding instructor, whom they loved dearly, turns out that she wasn't who she said she was. But we, by that stage, you know, I'd been in this game for about 8-9 years now, in the early 90s, and operating in Russia, you just assumed that you were under surveillance, and you assumed a much higher level of skill in the operatives who were trying to monitor your movements and conversations. But when I showed my daughters evidence that they had been cross-examined, they, you know, in their naivety, they just couldn't believe that. Oh, how could the lovely Svet? Oh, but she was so nice, and she used to give us sweeties, and she used to take us riding, and oh, she was, you know. But they were only young at the time. They're only young.
Yeah, yeah. When you were detained, did you have any sort of like stock excuses you would use to try and, you know, get out of detention?
Yeah, when we did our training in Ashford, the people who were training us were old sweats of the mission, and we used to practice being detained, as it were. And the most commonly used excuse was that you were bird watching.
Well, a bit like in the Great Escape, when they're doing the documents in there.
Well, it was the only way in which we could explain having a 1,000 millimeter glass lens on two Nikon F3 drives and binoculars and night vision goggles and a Modulux night camera, amongst other things. But no, it really didn't matter what excuse you gave, because everybody was playing the same game. Everybody knew the reality. And in fact, when I ended up in Russia, I came across people I had met in the mission, and they were going by a different name then. But we used to have a laugh about these sort of things. So I would say that I was lost when I got detained. I would say, which was not too far from the truth. I was bird watching. I was testing out the vehicle's cross-country capability. I was a I liked to collect number plate records, and of course, I'm a collector of Soviet memorabilia, military memorabilia, which was entirely true, and invariably I could prove that. But you made these excuses with your tongue in your cheek, and knowing that they knew full well what you were doing, because they were doing it themselves in West Germany, Soxmas operating, although they didn't have to work in the same way as we did. We provided so much information free of charge in West Germany. You only had to listen to BFBS radio or subscribe to regimental magazines, watch BFBS TV, and you didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to get yourself dirty and go onto training areas to find out who was stationed where, who the people were. Whereas all of this stuff we had to fight for. We had to fight for this information. When I say fight, I mean we had to go and collect it. It wasn't being offered to us on a plate.
When we were chatting before we came on air, you talked to me about sometimes the Soviets would set up sort of like demonstrations for you.
Yes. More often than not, we had to work really hard to discover the whereabouts of a particular bit of equipment. And we had to use stealth and subterfuge sometimes and put ourselves at some risk in order to gain photographic coverage of a particular item of equipment. And the reaction of the Soviets when they saw us was commensurate with them not wishing us to have seen it. In stark contrast, there were occasions when things were ridiculously easy for us. And I remember one occasion, I was not involved in this, when it was during the time when Pershing 2 and intermediate nuclear forces were being discussed. And a tour went out onto the Haufeld training area and came across, right out in the open, an SS-23, a nuclear capable intermediate nuclear force, which just sat there, and we believe that that and other items sometimes were placed out for us to find, in order that the West could be sure that the most modern and sophisticated military equipment was being deployed onto what they considered their front line. There seemed to be no pattern to it, so we fought for 6 months to get hold of images of a particular bit of equipment called 2S6. We mounted multiple operations to recover a reactive armor box from a Soviet tank. We only got fleeting images of MiG-29 and Su-27. And then the next day, you would find the new variant of self-propelled artillery parked out there in the open. Or in one occasion, a crew went out onto the tank ranges and came across towed artillery, the new, I think it was 2A65, brand new 152mm towed artillery, left out in the open, in the middle of the ranges. We concluded that these were demonstration events. And the same happened to the team who flew the Chipmunk over East Berlin. You probably know that Operation Oberon, where Bricksmith used to man the aircraft that used to fly over within 20, I think, nautical miles.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Of the center of Berlin, which took them over Soviet garrisons. On occasions, they used to find stuff which had been deliberately left out in the open, as opposed to what normally happened when the chipmunk got airborne. Stuff would be shoved back in their hangars out of sight. But on occasions, they would go across the Dahlgard-Oberitz training area or the Potsdam garrison, 35 Motor Rifle Division, and just find stuff being left for them to photograph to their heart's content.
I get the SS-23 because there were those arms control negotiations going on, and so therefore they perhaps just wanted to say, look, this is here. But the other stuff, are they trying to just say, look, we've got some really good kit here? Or I'm trying to understand their reasoning.
Yeah, I don't think I can really help you there, Ian, because we didn't really understand it as well. But what was really difficult to find on one day was suddenly presented to us on another.
Yes, a bit of a mystery that. Can you tell me about Operation Tomahawk?
Yes. Well, Operation Tomahawk was an operation which was really what the people in London called the goose that laid the golden egg. They often said results of would justify the existence of the mission on their own, without any of the other stuff that we provided. Operation Tomahawk was so valuable. And Operation Tomahawk involved exploiting Soviet and East German military rubbish tips. And the reason we exploited them was because the Soviets and the East Germans had no form of disposal of classified documents. They used to crunch them up and throw them in the waste paper. And that waste paper was then added to all of the other rubbish from a unit, including from the medical station. So bandages and syringes, including from the kitchens, so rotting food. And it was all bundled into a Soviet military lorry. We used to call them GGG, Gash Garrison Garbage. And this would drive out to the local rubbish tip, and it would tip. And we would be tasked to go to rubbish tips either as a planned operation. So in advance of West Berlin, we were told that we were to go and visit this particular tip on this particular night. Or if we came across a Gash Garrison garbage vehicle leaving a Soviet barracks, we would follow it and we would stand off and watch and look exactly where it tipped its load. And then we would disappear and we'd come back normally in between the hours of 2 and 4 in the morning. And we'd park the vehicle up somewhere away from the site so as not to leave any tire marks. We would dress in specialist rubber overboots. We would wear protective gloves and clothing. And we would carry with us East German potato sacks so that if we had to dump the sacks in a hurry, it couldn't be attributed as to anything from the West. And we would go, two of us, the tour officer and the tour NCO, would disappear off, and one would rummage in amongst the rubbish whilst the other kept a lookout with night vision goggles. Normally it was the Russian speaker who would go through the paperwork, but actually we didn't really read what we were picking up. We just used to shovel everything into these East German potato sacks. Any paperwork at all, whether it was handwritten or whether it was printed matter, would all get shoveled into the bag. and the place used to stink. There were rats running everywhere. There were stray dogs. And quite often, the Soviets would not use a rubbish tip itself. They would just drive out of their barracks onto a bit of wasteland near their barracks wall and just tip it and drive off again. So quite often, this would be happening right under the noses of the Soviet barracks. So you had to keep an eye out. And then you would take these sacks full of material back to your vehicle. You would tape them up and double bag them because it stank, and then take it back to West Berlin, where we had a team of specialists, the Tomahawk team, whose job it was to sift through bags and bags and bags of Soviet military rubbish. Clearly, paper has its shelf life, so you really had to get on site that night or perhaps the night afterwards in order for, you know, if it rained or something, all this stuff could deteriorate. But it really was one of the most unpleasant tasks we did, particularly when, as we often had occasion to do, you had to go and visit the rubbish tips used by the military hospitals. At that stage, we were very interested, or London was very interested, in casualties coming back from Afghanistan, which were being treated in East Germany. And a lot of the paperwork that they threw away was about numbers, injuries, treatment received. But, you know, you were dealing with medical wastes, including human waste, including human limbs. It was awful. It was awful. And it was usually did it on the last night of the tour so that you didn't have to spend too long in the vehicle with this bag of or bags of stuff. And you could get it back to Berlin safely and hand it over, and it would all be tipped out on this huge table, and people used to sort through it, and you would be absolutely astonished at what the Soviets used to throw away. Their classified material, technical manuals, maps. And we used to collect this stuff, not just from tips, but also from deployment areas. So if we discovered the Soviets were deployed in a particular area of a training area, we used to wait until they had gone and then go in and look around at what they had left, because the Soviets didn't issue their troops with loo paper. So when the soldiers needed to go to the loo, they used to pick up any bit of paper that they could and disappear off into the bushes and do their business. So we used to go and find their business and find what they had wiped their bottoms on and put it in bags and take it back with us. And it was doing things like that which alerted us to all sorts of things. So people used to use private letters which they had received from home. On that letter was a unit address number. So we used to, they're called FPNs. We used to get field postal numbers. We used to get letters from parents expressing hopes and worries about what was going on back at home. We used to find people used to wipe their bums on maps, on the technical manuals. We found organization charts for units, what they were equipped with, how many people, where they were going. It was the first reference we got to a piece of equipment called 2S6. That was recovered on a piece of paper, which was recovered from these ad hoc latrines. So it was a very fruitful but smelly and horrid thing to have to do. And no matter how many gloves you wore or boots, socks, the stench stayed with you. But, you know, Operation Tomahawk provided just an endless amount of both low-level and operational-level intelligence as a result of them not issuing their troops with loo paper and not having a shredder in the office.
That Tomahawk team must have had strong stomachs when they had to go through that stuff.
Yeah, but they loved it. You know, because there wasn't a day that went past when they hadn't come across some golden nugget, you know. And them's the breaks. Yeah.
Incredible. Did you have any regrets about your time with the mission?
I'd probably say I only had two. One was that I wasn't able to serve even longer, because I think after 2 years in the job,
you really felt comfortable with what you were doing. But the army posting systems required that I moved on after 2 years. So it was 2 years in training and 2 years in the mission. I suppose the other regret I have was an incident which happened quite late on into my tour, which has a funny side to it, but is something that I regret at the time. It was to do with a deployment of the Soviet SA-11 air defense system. A tour had been out and had seen this complete system, including the command vehicles and associated radars, deploying onto a local training area, and I was due to go out next. And I was determined to get eyes on this system. It was a new system, and to get a good photography of it would have been a first for the mission. So I was really up for this. And I went out with a crew, and we got near the training area by night. We concealed ourselves in the woods nearby. And it was summertime, so we needed to wait until first light at about 4:30 a.m. until we could go into the training area and do our typical dirty dash. So the sun came up, but I had to wait until such time as there was sufficient light to use a 250th of a second on my F3 camera with a 500mm lens. And I needed that speed because I anticipated that I would have to be shooting a film from a moving vehicle, perhaps of a moving vehicle. So I had to have quite a lot of light to get that speed up there. And even a 250th of a second was pushing the limit. Anyway, finally, I don't know, about 5:30, 6 o'clock, something like that, the light was sufficient for us to go. And we'd already made our plans. We'd talked about what would happen if, etc. And I fully expected, because this was a sensitive piece of equipment, that we would get a frosty reception. Anyway, we went in and we drove straight into the training area and relied on that element of surprise that I've talked about before. And sure enough, there it was. SA-11 missiles, tube arm radar was there, I think, Snowdrift, the command vehicle, the whole lot. And I started taking the photos as we drove past. And sure enough, there was an instant reaction from the Soviets. At which point we speeded up somewhat. I was still shooting film out the window, and then they started to chase us. And that chase developed into quite a hairy chase. They chased us for a long way. I determined that there was a high chance of us being caught. And the last thing I wanted was to have to strip the film out of the camera so that there was nothing for the Soviets to find. So what I did was I unloaded the camera of the film that I had taken. And so I had all the camera bodies were empty just in case we were caught and our equipment was seized. Anyway, we managed to get out of the situation after some miraculous driving once again by the driver. And we went back to Berlin, cock a hoop that we had managed to get this scoop, as it was known in the mission, of SA-11 and all its component parts. So news quickly got round the mission that we had managed to do this, and people waited with bated breath to see the photographic results. And I submitted all the films into Special Section, who did all the photographic stuff, and back came the films. But there was none, the SA-11 radar system or the missiles. And I knew that I had taken shots of this system, and I was completely perplexed as to why there weren't any shots of this system. And so we became, the tour NCO and I, we became a bit of a laughingstock in as much as we had promised this scoop, but we had failed to deliver. Anyway, about 3 months later, I decided it was time to get my winter parka dry cleaned in preparation for the forthcoming winter. And so I got the parka out and I patted the parka down and checked the pockets, nothing there. And just before handing it in, and rolling it up and handing it in, I felt something inside the jacket. And I couldn't locate it until I found a little hole in the lining. And in the lining of this jacket, deep down in the down of the jacket, I felt something which was very similar to a a canister, a roll of film. And sure enough, it was a roll of film. And it, what happened, I didn't remember doing this, was in my anxiety not to lose this roll of film, I had taken the film out of the camera while we were bouncing along on the training area with a WAS 469 in pursuit, and a GAS 66. And I had shoved it inside the lining of my parka, and I had forgotten about it completely. I know it sounds odd, but really had forgotten about it. And this was about 3 months later. Anyway, I took it back into special section, and I asked the sergeant there if he could quite quietly develop the film, because I didn't know exactly what it was. I had a good idea. It was the missing film. And sure enough, back came all the photos of the systems that we had taken. Sadly, by that stage, the scoop had already been bagged by another tour, and so we couldn't claim rights to it. And I had to come clean and own up to the fact that I had failed to hand in this film. Of course, in the meantime, this film had been just sat in my parka in an insecure environment, a highly classified film, and it almost went to the German equivalent of Sketchley's with this highly classified film inside my parka. But fortunately, I managed to find it and get it developed. However, I did have an interview with the ops officer afterwards, and I can assure you that there was an interview without any coffee whatsoever.
Brilliant. Brilliant. For those of you that don't know, an interview without coffee is essentially a right. Telling off will be the mild version, but I think you can probably imagine the rest. Stephen, you've been so generous with your time with me, but is there anything else Bricksmith-wise?
I don't think so. I think the intelligence gathering has been covered in by many other people, and multiple books have been written about who we were and what we got up to. I just wanted to bring, rather than concentrate on what everybody knows about Bricksmith, is what people perhaps didn't realise, which is the human side of the interaction that we had with people who were doing a job like us, who had the same fears, aspirations, hopes as us. And it was just that we happened to be born in different places that we were doing these particular jobs. But I regarded it as the most rewarding and the most exciting time that I have had in uniform, working in three-man teams where the rank gradient was blurred. There was total interdependence and reliance on people who were at the top of their game, the tour NCOs, incredibly professional, capable, brave people. And most of all, the drivers. I wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for the drivers who were just an extraordinary breed of people, as well as being bloody good drivers. So I just wanted to bring that human side, you know, what it was like to tour in a vehicle for 6 days and five nights and go and collect Soviet loo paper or the equivalent thereof, and then give a East German policeman a bollocking and end up in a Soviet jail and have someone's Iron Cross, which hangs on my wall right here, and I'm looking at it now. That was the human side of what we did.
There are photos and videos illustrating this episode in our episode notes. Look for the link in the podcast information. Now, this podcast would not exist without our financial supporters, and I want to thank one and all of them for their generous support. If you want to help us, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.